This is the 3D Pod, your number one source for 3D printing news, analysis, and insight from 3DPrint.com. Now, here are your hosts, Joris Peels and Maxwell Bogue.
Hi, everyone. My name is Joris Peels, and this is another episode of the 3D Pod. And with me, as always, is Maxwell Bogue. How you doing, Max?
I'm good, Joris. How you doing? Happy New Year.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Happy New Year to you, too. I hope you had a wonderful time.
I had a great time. I had a lovely little dinner party in New York City. So can't complain. How about yourself? Do anything fun?
We were fun. We were in Paris. So Paris is really nice. And we walked around outside and saw the Eiffel Tower, that kind of stuff. So it was really nice. Really nice.
Yeah, what dilettantes we sound like.
We're nerds. I swear, we're nerds.
We're super nerds. Let's prove that. Who do we have on the 3D Pod today so we can talk about additive manufacturing?
Okay, so we have Shannon Maduren on 3D Pod today. And Shannon is, she started doing all sorts of stuff. She started Linear Mold. It was like a really very early company that got involved in metal 3D printing in the States. A really long time ago, 2014 now. And she worked for Smith & Nephew. She worked at Vulcan Forms for a while. And she's done a lot of stuff for AMUG. And now she's the owner of her own consultancy, Layered Manufacturing. It was like a communications / 3D printing consultancy, let's say. And she is the brand spanking new, relatively new, president of AMUG. So that's really cool. And that's why we're talking to her about all things AMUG and about her journey in additive as well. So welcome to the show, Shannon.
Thanks, Joris. I appreciate being here. Add just a little color to the history. There was a brief delay in there, which is probably how it was missed, but I actually started back in 2010 with Materialize and went from there to 3D Systems, actually to a smaller company, Rapid Product Development Group, which was 2 months later acquired by 3D. So I do have a little bit more color even before the Linear Mold days. With Materialize being a really great launch pad for somebody coming into additive manufacturing.
Totally. I worked there myself for a couple of years, so I really like the. It's a really great company, great place to learn as well. So let's talk a little bit. How did you get started in additive then? What was your first contact with additive? Was it like, were you all about this technology, or did you just kind of blunder into it like so many people?
Funny you would say blunder, because I would use that word often for me. I did blunder into it, as a matter of fact. In 2010, I joined Materialize. I was living in Michigan at that time, and they were based in Michigan for their U.S. Operations. And I joined them initially just as a receptionist. I shouldn't say just, that makes it sound small. It's a very important role. Joined them as a receptionist and was very swiftly infatuated with the technology itself and just dove right in and learned everything that I could. And one of the reasons I say Materialize is such a great place for a starter is they're doing so many things and their software is so present and impactful in so many lanes of the additive manufacturing market, vertically speaking, as well as they were doing production right there on the floor in Plymouth, Michigan for medical applications for patient specific. So the more I kind of drowned myself in learning what was happening, I was quickly moved away from the reception desk and into marketing and then into their Surgicase product where we were selling patient specific instrumentation and models for upper extremity interventions, distal radius malunions, congenital deformities. And my degree is in biology and have a love for orthopedics anyway on a personal vein. So that really created quite a love affair for me to watch the technology. And the gift of really seeing it go to the end application sometimes isn't met. And in that role, it certainly was because we would sell it to the surgeon. We would go through the CAD of doing DICOM images to CAD, and then I would accompany those in the operating room. So see it really right from ideation to application in a patient's body was just so special. And the love affair was well seated and continues today.
That's, of course, a very special place to start off because it's, well, I like it because a lot of people start off really abstract, but you've got the guys there taking the models out of the powder bed, and you've got the guy people finishing them. They're going to certain, so it's really kind of very plastic, kind of really hands-on place to get started, right?
Absolutely. You really see the story of the additive part. And sometimes the story is virtual for us in the service industry because we don't see where it lands or what the impact is because that happens behind closed doors of whomever our more corporate customer is. But yes, patient-specific applications and having the opportunity to be in the operating room, you're really following that journey from inception to execution, and Materialize really gave me that gift of throwing me into that and allowing me to play in that space for a few years with them. And I just loved it.
And what was it like selling these solutions in the beginning, these patient-specific solutions? Was that very difficult? Were people not believing this, or was everybody like completely on board, like, let's do this? Or was it like, was a lot of reticence still?
Yeah, great question, Joris. In fact, it was difficult, and probably it's a little less difficult now because 3D printing is more readily available to hospital systems than it was in 2010, 2011. One thing was there was unfamiliarity and uncertainty. Also, you're selling directly to surgeons who are very proud of their education and their practicing years with their hands with standard instrumentation and making their decisions on the fly. And we want them. We don't want them fully reliant on technology. We want them to have the aptitude to perform where technology might not be exactly what they want. Also, a problem that still happens today is it's a non-reimbursable commodity. So the hospital cannot bill for the usage of that. So you really have to plead with them to understand the back end savings, better patient outcomes, less blood loss, quicker turnover of the OR because there's less trays, less cleaning than post-surgery. I know if we jump later in my career to my Smith and Nephew days, a standard instrumentation would have about 11 trays. When we would go in with patient specific on knees, it would be 1.5 trays. So one spatially in the OR, it takes up less. And on the cleaning end, there's a cost to the hospitals on sterilizing all of those trays. So not only were you selling the technology and the patient specific application, but then you have to address the financial bit of that with the C-suite of why you would want to introduce something else that they cannot get paybacks for. If you're having better patient outcomes, maybe you have lesser readmits. If you're turning an OR faster, now maybe instead of 7 surgeries a day, you might be able to get 8 or 9 surgeries a day because that room is churning a little bit quicker. If they're saving on the sterilization end, there's a cost. And I always tried to nail this down with hospitals, what that cost is. It seemed to hover around $100 a tray. So if we are washing only 1.5 trays, which essentially is 2 going through the washing system, as opposed to 11, there's monetary savings there as well. So the appeal was really on 2 counts, 1 to the surgeon and 2 to the financial end of the hospital or outpatient surgery center.
And how is it, what would you recommend for people? Because we kind of have to do this kind of like this, turning the tide, making this like from a something that few people do to what many people need to do. That's something that mm-hmm. right now is really important for people. How do you do that? Do you go to the most innovative people first and then tell everybody, oh my God, the guys at really cool Hospital X are doing it? Is that the way, just to drag them in by one by one, or what would you recommend?
Yeah, you're talking about specifically patient-specific applications?
Yeah, generally, but I think there's a lot of learnings there. A lot of people are doing pioneering work, but everybody's just thinking that in orthopedics it's one thing, whereas in hearing aids it's another thing, and somebody else is trying to do it in conformal cooling, whatever. But that kind of like that, you know, going from these 1 or 2 POCs, right, some proof of concepts, to everyone in the industry, you know, wanting it. Well, that happened in a few things, like hearing aids, for example, and propulsion systems for space. But a lot of other stuff, just it always is that pioneering thing. Like 10 years later, it's like, yeah, we're just working with the lighthouse people, and you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's a general all-encompassing answer, and then there's probably a little bit different answer as you're talking about just patient-specific applications. And my experience only rests in orthopedics. I haven't been involved in hearing aids or cardiac applications. But in orthopedics, I think there's as much evidence available of great outcomes with additive intervention as there are without additive intervention, and probably more without, because they've been longer doing surgeries with standard instrumentation. So you really need innovative minds, having surgeon champions. I always in my career have enjoyed selling with evidence. So the more documentation we can have, I know while I was at Smith & Nephew, they did a large metadata analysis where they were tracking outcomes from patients. So I think where we can provide numbers on that vein, that's helpful. And I know there's a big push right now to appeal to CMS to get reimbursement codes. We are one step further in that they have made medical codes for patient-specific applications, but they come with a $0 reimbursement today. But step one is hit. Yes, we do have codes made. If we're talking more generically, where maybe we would encompass all markets, yes, I think going to bat with a story, with evidence of success, certainly having champions or KOLs, key opinion leaders, that are showcasing what their favorable results have been, how it has gained them strides in whatever they're doing, strides in design, strides in perhaps less shifts on a floor. If you're talking conformal cooling, your largest timeline on an injection molded part is the cooling cycle. If you can introduce properly conformal cooling, you might be able to reduce that cooling cycle. Let's just pick a number, 50%. You now have a less of a timeline for your molded parts, which if you're molding parts, those are production and there's some quantity to those. You might be able to, one, either reallocate an injection mold press to another part, or perhaps it is that you go from three shifts to two shifts because you're more efficient now that you're using conformal cooling. So there are all kinds of wins if you're willing to take the time to study why they're wins and provide categorically where the savings might come. There's a quote, what gets measured gets improved, right? If we're not willing to take the time to measure what we're doing and what those outcomes are, we can't really viably proclaim our success or get better. I think if we think it's doing something and we measure it and we say, oh, we're getting better by 50%, but the measurement comes in and it's only 10%, we've got to go back and figure out how we get to that higher percentage. So it's about knowing your audience. What industry are you appealing to? Where are their struggle points? And does additive solve those? And there are times that additive isn't the solution. And that's the important thing for us to be cognizant of. It's the perfect solution for the perfect problem. It isn't the perfect solution for all things, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, we should definitely be careful. And really, I think it's always a really powerful thing to say no. And everybody knows they don't like it, especially if you're like a salesperson. You don't like doing it. But it's really, really powerful to say, you know what? You should do this thing, or you should do a different thing, and this is not for you. And I think and it really conserves your market, and it really conserves, like, you know, make sure that the people you do spend the next 6 months working with are going to have a good time, not that it's some really frustrating thing that gets no one anywhere, really.
You are so right, Joris. I actually love the answer no. While it may not yield a project for me, what it does is it yields reliance for them to trust me, because I know that perhaps whatever they're chasing is better met by some conventional need. I'm also not afraid of I don't know, but my every I don't know is followed up with I'll get the answer for you. And that's an important thing too, to have a Rolodex of resources in your back pocket, that if you're asked a question, don't guess and mislead somebody. Make sure that you know either the right people or how to find the right people. Use your network. Additive manufacturing is such an intimate family, and I love it. You can call out. It might take one call. It might take six calls, but chances are you can find the answer. And that's an important thing, especially if it's a first-time customer using additive manufacturing. We want them to be met with success. If we introduce them to additive in a poor, stingy, greedy way and they aren't met with success, we're going to have a really hard time walking them around the corner to come back and give it another go. It's really better to be responsible and forthcoming so that they can enjoy the victory properly when it's the right application.
So and then after Materialize, you went and worked, well, you worked for a small firm that got acquired by 3D Systems. Not a very unique story given the time frame. So what was that like? That was a very different type of journey, I think.
It was. And you know, when I went there, it wasn't that I was disenchanted with 3D Systems. In fact, they created such a hunger for me. I was enamored with 3D printing. And at that time in Plymouth, all they had there was SLA and SLS. And I was quite hungry to learn more. And 3D Systems, well, I went to Rapid Product Development Group, but it was very quickly purchased by 3D Systems. 3D Systems had such a bigger offering, and I was hungry to learn. So yes, going to 3D Systems, it was a different job because then I was selling for their quick parts division. So basically on-demand parts. And the way that they were organized at that time was it was geographical. So it wasn't vertical market based. I had a certain territory that I was selling solutions to, but I could sell SLA, SLS. They didn't have metals yet at that time, 3D. We could sell Stratasys' solutions of FDM and PolyJet. I could sell injection molding, machining. So it really taught me the marriage and the importance of how it all fits in and the pros and cons of each and where you unite them and where you divide them. 3D Systems taught me so much about the wider span of offering and the opportunity that they gave me to talk to so many different verticals because I was very medical focused at 3D. At Materialize. What a journey. And it was an insatiable hunger to know what people are doing and why. I love nothing more than walking companies' floors and looking around and just offering conversation of, have you considered this? Does this fit? Would this help? Where do you struggle? So it was a very different role for me. It was kind of feet on the street sales, but I think I loved it because I loved what I was selling. And I loved that I just wanted to solve. I love people and I love solving. So it was just a people-y puzzle and it was terrific.
No, there's a lot to be said about learning from those kinds of environments. I know I'm always very thankful for a similar kind of experience of working for a company to teach me better what I wanted to do, but didn't know how to do. So they paid to teach me.
So. Yes. Yes, Max, that is right.
So then you went to, later on you were at Smith & Nephew. That's a much more traditional, far larger company really, that where 3D printing is all of a sudden like a really small part of what they do really, right?
Yeah, very small. They were only offering, well, they had a couple things going on. I was on the Visionaire team, which is the patient-specific instrumentation and models for their knee replacement, both their uni knee and their full total knee. Uni knee is where you're just replacing one of the condyles of the femur and the other is full. And we were using additive manufacturing. Their product line is called Visionaire. They had me come in as a field marketing manager. And really what that role was supporting the sales efforts of knee replacement. So they had their team. There were two of us in this role. We were basically divided by the Mississippi, essentially. But the salespeople would be working with surgeons to sell the implants, the physical implants themselves. And then it was an add-on sale for them to add the Visionaire product. Visionaire, again, being the SLS models and instrumentation. Some of them were lucky enough to have a great number of surgeons or some heavy surgeon users. And then they would pull me into the field with the surgeon. Sometimes it might be on sales. If they wanted to introduce the surgeon to Visionaire, I might join them for a dinner or in surgeon's office hours to explain what we would do, how we would do it, and what to expect. Sometimes they would ask me to come out and join them for the first surgery of the surgeon because the salesperson wasn't that was selling the implants wasn't as deeply vested into the Visionaire product So they would call and say, the Dr. Jones is going to use Vision Air for the first time. Would you please fly out in the event there are any questions that I don't know how to answer? And of course, I would happily do that. Smith and Nephew was present at multiple medical orthopedic trade shows. So sometimes I would join the team out for those. A really important aspect of the team are the engineers that are designing it. They have so much more wisdom than I do because they're the ones that are really evaluating the MRI and the X-ray to design these. So their conversations were always filled with wisdom, and I just loved it. They were harder to get away from the desk because they had a role to do for surgeons across the U.S., but sometimes I would snag an engineer and bring them with me as well.
But, I mean, that sounds like pretty classic standard, you know, medical marketing, so to speak, or medical sales. Was there anything that was particularly unique or different given the additive aspect of things, or did it just fall into the classic model of sales for medical devices?
They were unique in that they used dual modality for scanning. They used MRI and X-ray. So that was just a double checkpoint. But as far as the product, they were running SLS machines and printing them out with unique identifiers, just like most others are. But Smith & Nephew's uniqueness was dual modality of scanning. But there's a lot of companies using patient-specific applications, and the only ones I've seen are using SLS technology. Medical modeling, separate from that, is becoming more prominent, and hospitals are doing that independently as well.
Well, a little bit more broadly, what are your thoughts on the future of this, just generally, like additive in orthopedics? It seems at the moment it's booming. There's a lot of startups. There's a lot of really big company interests, a lot of products coming out. Are you, is this just going to like conquer the whole skeletal system? What are your feelings on the orthopedics and 3D printing?
Yeah, I think it's wide open for continued growth. You know, if you think of a commodity knee, there's not a lot of patient-specific implants themselves, although there are some. If you think of your femur, my femur, Max's femur, we all have very different sizes. We have different nuances of our pathology, our bone structure. And when they're commodity pieces, say they're size 1 through 8, you could have your body might be between a size 4 and 5 and not a perfect fit. And they're just going to have to make it work. There's disadvantages to undersizing and there's disadvantages to oversizing. So that's where the surgeon's training and experience is so valuable. I think the more we get into customization, the better patient outcomes that happen. Like on a knee replacement, the tibial plate, if that is overhanging, you're going to have soft tissue impingement, which equates to pain, which is not good. We don't want to have pain on the outcome of surgery. So I think, too, with the pricing, additive manufacturing, metals especially, is a bit cost prohibitive. Point of entry is rough, right? It's an expensive machine. It's an expensive investment operationally for your facility, for all of the ancillary equipment, to get qualified folks to run your machines and your CAD. So that point of entry is tough. Your first pass yield, rough. You're bringing in a new machine, you're probably not printing stellar parts for a few months. So I think as the machines come down in price, become more user-friendly, in addition to that, we get more additive manufacturing aptitude out there in the workforce where there's a larger pool of people with experience to run it. Perhaps the salaries will change or just the availability of people who say want to move to whatever. We were just talking Cincinnati a few minutes ago, Cincinnati, Ohio. Maybe there will be a larger pool of folks in each geographic area. So I think there's nothing but improvement and growth to come in orthopedics.
But would you envision that still happening in a service center style, or do you think it would actually start showing up in the hospitals, or is it too much of an investment for the hospitals to take on the staff and be producing something like on that level?
Yeah, great. Great question. I think in the hospitals, we're seeing models which are not for use or patient intervention. They're just a reference model preoperatively. So we're seeing those in hospitals where you get into medical devices that require 510K clearance. That's a big undertaking for a hospital. So I don't foresee that happening soon, where they would be making products and printing products. One, they would have to have the engineers to do that on site at the hospital. They would have to be an ISO 13485 facility prepared for FDA audits and registration. The ability to run those machines, I would think there would be some unease from a COO of a hospital to bring titanium printers, combustible into a building with sick people. Yeah, I don't really see that terribly soon. Now, if you say, where I thought you were going to go with that question was, do you think that this will happen at contract manufacturers versus at the OEMs? I think we're seeing some change in that. And that really depends on the appetite of the OEM. One, do they have the real estate for a production floor of metal printers and ancillary equipment? And two, do they want that burden? And I've seen it both ways. I certainly know companies that are doing their printing themselves. I know companies that have one or two printers and they use those as their prototype, but then they send production outward. And some do all of their production outward. That just is not the stone they want to polish. They want their internal people to be polishing design stones.
Fair enough.
And we are seeing, like, the HSS is doing it, the hospitals for special surgery, they're doing it. And do you really think that's a special case because they have so much volume, they're so large, they have so much money? And it's all TK and other similar kind of procedures.
Yep.
You think they're like more the exception really than, and you think there are very few other people are going to be able to do this or?
Yeah, they are an exception. And that was a really interesting change when they brought Lima Corporate in with their EBM machines. And I don't have firsthand knowledge. So let me preface this with, this is all Shannon opinion and no facts. I do believe that the printing that is happening at HSS is under the reign of Lima Corporate. So it's just that their house of machines happens to reside there, but the onus of the design and printing is still that of Lima Corporate. Again, qualify that as an I think. I don't know true.
I believe the same thing to be true. So that would be a way around, like, a lot of the safety concerns. It's a separate building. They're responsible. Yep. They get the liability, that kind of thing. So there is a way out of it. And what about, like, other things? Like, if you're talking about not full-blown implants, maybe, but how about, like, you know, just one-off implants? There are more kind of special use authorization, more kind of exceptions. Mm-hmm. You could really do some real pioneering work as a hospital to print these really easy edge cases, these new medical devices. Mm-hmm. And I could start with just a one-off case, you know, and you know, like a one-off CMF stuff or, you know, one-off kind of brace or one-off. You see that happen? That's much more likely because that would be much easier, right, to do.
Yeah. Well, one place I know that happens is at Walter Reed Medical Center. Pete Leocouris is a great member of our additive family, and he does a lot with the additive lab at Walter Reed, doing a lot of the emergent cases that you're speaking of, where you get a special use case where you don't have the whole 510K process going through because you have an emergent need. One of our soldiers has something come up that needs attention immediately. I would anticipate probably the VA may already be doing that as well, or is probably on the cusp. Those are kind of sister hospitals, and Beth Ripley, who runs the additive push for the VA hospital, I know works very closely with Pete Leocouris at different shows and things. I see them together an awful lot, sometimes co-presenting. So in those applications, we know that that's happening. As far as regular hospitals, I've certainly read articles. There was an article a few years ago about the titanium printed ribs. Was that in Australia, I feel like? I could be wrong on that.
Yeah, I think that was Paul Urshan or Anatomics did some stuff by that it was in Paul. Australia.
Yep, it was Paul. So I think where people are willing to take a risk like that, we might see that. Now, how risk averse is the nation and is the hospital? I think that's a question we probably can't answer, and that will come individually. But I think the more outward storytelling of success that happens, of how it's being used, the more you might whet the appetite for others to give it a go.
To me, it's really logical that if you're going to invent a new device, then doing it in an environment where you have access to printers and you can put them in the body will give you a huge head start. And you see that also with these people now working on all the trachea, people that are working on trachea because it's just easier to get patients, let's say. And there you're really seeing that that's the cutting edge. And that's automatically connected with 3D printing. So if you're kind of like a doctor who also wants to invent devices, or if you were maybe thinking of commercializing a startup, it's a really beautiful place to be. If you could choose between two hospitals and one is doing that avant-garde stuff, let's say, then that would be the place to be.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. And I think orthopedics is probably the easiest story to tell, and probably the more likely to adapt surgeon, because essentially an orthopedic surgeon is a carpenter and a maker, right? They're chiseling away at bones and solving and reuniting bones, which is much of where additive comes in. So I think they are much more open to receipt of the story of additive manufacturing and how the impact might be supplemental to their practice. Now, I've certainly run into surgeons along my journey who say they don't have no need. They have no need for technology. They're perfectly good with their hands, and God love them. And thank you for that. We want that. So there are some that are open and there are some that are not. But I think medical is just wide open for continued growth, continued innovation. Even we've seen this partnership between 3D Systems and a biopharma company that they, I don't have too much firsthand knowledge. I just remember reading an article about it where they are combining the biopharma with the implant at point of insertion to allow hopefully for better outcomes on that too. So I think it's just so wide open and so exciting. And I hope that I get to be involved in so much more that's coming.
And the other thing is, okay, one thing I think we can all agree on that is happening, and you know, a couple of years ago, there's one or two, I was looking for an article, and it was like 5-6 years ago, and maybe one or two labs with a hospital doing that, what you were referring to earlier, like doing these in-house models and doing these kind of models, for teaching purposes or for planning, that kind of thing. But now we've seen that expand really, really quite rapidly. And also, like, there are some reimbursement codes now. So that's set, I think, to grow much, much larger, that kind of, you know, having kind of an Ultimaker and a Forum Labs in-house and doing that. Do you see a lot of real advantage coming from that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the first point of awareness, right? When you can bring in models to a doctor who isn't using them intraoperatively, but they can see one. I've done it myself. My own son had spinal surgery back in 2017. And just because I was in the field, I could do it. I took his MRI and had it segmented and printed his full spine for the surgical team who didn't need it. It was a scoliosis surgery, not overly complex to them. But my son at that time was 17. And what I saw happen personally was when the doctor was holding up this 3D rendering of his spine, Gunnar was old enough to understand what he was saying. It's not like it was a small child. And he was talking about what they were going to manipulate, where the rods would go, where the screws would go. So one, from a patient communication standpoint, all Gunnar knew was that he was going to have his back opened up, but now he had a little bit of understanding. And I, as the parent, of course, give me every nugget of wisdom I can have. But from a surgical perspective, perhaps they used that for looking at the pedicles to determine which size screw they would need. One thing in the operating room is they're looking at a bone structure and saying, well, I think it's probably this size screw. They put it through. It's not big enough. So they're making some guesses intraoperatively. Also on other applications, not on a scoliosis application, looking at a model might help them determine point of insertion to be most successful to correct whatever they're going after. There's lots of really extraordinary decision-making that can happen by looking at a model. Now, do you need a model for every case? No. Did they need one for this spine case? No. But there are certainly complex and puzzling interventions that land before a doctor's toes all over the world, in where these models can come in and create some awareness before the patient is open on the table. And I forget the statistic. I used to know it when I was with Smith and Nephew, but for every so many seconds open in the operating room, patient open in the operating room, your chances of infection goes up by a certain percentage. So if they're making intraoperative decisions, perhaps the patient is open longer. If they can make some decisions before they get the patient on the table, then maybe that time can be reduced, which has obvious benefits later.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, what is your view of the market generally? We talk a lot of medical because that's where most of your career is taking place. But you know, just generally, is this a happy time for 3D printing? Are we going to go by gangbusters, or do we have to kind of adjust a little bit more, kind of, you know, more reduced expectations perhaps for a couple of years because the economy and such?
Yeah. I think the lofty answer would be that we're doing great. The realistic answer would be that we're not doing great. And I don't think that the answer of we're not doing great rests just that the technology isn't great. I think we are in an arena. You just mentioned the economy. The economy is all over the map and will always change. And so we have to ride that in our personal lives with our own investments, whatever solutions that we're looking at. So I think some of that is on the economy. I think some of that can be on folks using additive manufacturing and not being met with success. Now, is that because it's the wrong application? Is it because they didn't have the right engineering? There can be any number of those things, or perhaps the salesperson sold them a machine for the sake of selling a machine and it wasn't the right one that would tend to their needs. I think that story can be very, very long. I think additive is here to stay. I think we have some great applications, great nuances. Obviously, aerospace and medical are two of the really prominent success stories of additive manufacturing. We're certainly seeing more from automotive. Will we meet their production needs on a standard vehicle? I don't know, maybe in conformal cooling, but certainly as they're prototyping or we're going to more the luxury / performance cars, we can see that. We know that Ford has a huge lab in Michigan of 3D printers. They haven't been real quiet about that. I've had the opportunity to go and visit that before. They're using that in many different ways. Some of them are teaching ways. Some are jigs and fixtures. Some can be parts. We saw... who had the gear shift that Azoth just did with the Hoganos parts? That has come out on a performance. Construction, fascinated. All of this cement printing that's happening around the world. I really know precious little about the facts of it, but boy, do I love to see those videos.
Joris isn't as big a fan, but I think it's very cool stuff.
Yeah, it's like a campfire. I love watching it.
Right?
I'm worried about people getting burned.
Yeah, you're worried about it falling down and stuff like that. But that matters.
Yeah. Yes. My intel on that is precious little, but I find it fascinating. And if it is safe and fast and cheap, like they tout it as being, then how exciting that perhaps we're providing shelter for more people that can't have shelter otherwise.
Yeah. It's funny on the construction. My grandfather used to do big construction projects. And his great innovation in the 1950s was to turn it into a production line to do a suburb where on day one, the guys would come and they would dig up the trenches for the piping and then like lay a flat piece of concrete. And then the next day, a crew would come and start the base of the building. And then the next day, they move to another location and do the base of the building and then so forth and so on. All they do is the base. So the line doesn't move, the workers move. But if you were to take that same mentality and then just slap a 3D printing gantry on top of it, you're pretty much there. And you can make a neighborhood very quickly as a result, for example, if suburbia is what you want. But
well, you know what? You might be very early into what is to come. Who knows?
Totally. And is there going to be more like, you know, 3D printing construction AMUG as well? Because I've been a little bit, there's not been a lot of that stuff. Are you guys going to be focusing a little bit more on that as well or not so much?
You know, that's a great question. 2 years ago, one of our scholarship winners was very involved in that and has a company. I believe he was out of Kentucky. could be wrong about that. Anyway, he won our scholarship. Remember, we give a scholarship to an educator and a student. He was an educator, and he was doing 3D printing construction with concrete studies with his students, and has now formed a company. And I wish I had a better memory to spit out his name for you. Here's a trouble with a challenge with AMUG when we're filling our tracks. So I was a track leader for AMUG for 8 years on the medical track, no surprise, before I joined the board. And we had lots of questions. You're not talking a lot about bioprinting, so much like this with construction. At that time, we didn't have a lot of people coming that were sharing those things. Thus, we didn't have a lot of attendees coming to learn those things. It's a tricky maneuver to get enough people at it. And what's enough is a question there, but getting people from the concrete industry to want to recognize AMUG as a great avenue and come and put them on a platform to speak. Would we welcome them? Heavens, yes. And then if perhaps they're on that platform, more of the concrete folks will start coming to AMUG. So it really is finding one or two people that want to be involved and get on the pedestal and talk on the microphone on our tracks and include those people. So it is a desire. I don't know. I haven't looked at the registration list just yet to know if we have anybody in concrete coming this year. But gosh, would I love to see it, because there's so much I don't know. Oh, funny story. Last year we have hands-on workshops there, and Oak Ridge National Laboratory did a concrete lab with us. It was so fun. They basically had caulk guns, and they gave us concrete and Dawn dish soap and water to simulate all the aggregates that go into concrete. And we had to determine our recipe for the concrete to lay. Would it be so thin that on extrusion it would come out as a bowl of soup? Would it become so thick that when we went to extrude it, we had a concrete block within the caulk gun? That was super fun. I failed, just so you know. Mine was too thick. It was a concrete block within the caulk gun, so I didn't get to extrude anything. My guess on recipe was poor. Some people did stellar. Some people pushed out soup. So that was fun. So that was one entry of kind of concrete simulation. And Oak Ridge took some time to teach us about the importance of creating that recipe of everything that goes into extruding concrete that holds its form and is viable to build structures. Because obviously layer on layer, you then have the fight of gravity and squish and deformation. So that was one entry again into introducing some concrete into AMUG.
Okay. So good, okay, but yeah, I think it'll be more as time goes on. So what are we going to find at AMUG this year? Remind us a little bit why we should be going and what we can expect.
Yes. You know, AMUG is my favorite work week of the year. And I don't say that just because I'm on the board. It was when I was doing nothing for AMUG other than showing up. It really is a 5-day time period spent with people who are passionate about the same things you are. And when that happens, conversation, coaching, sharing, problem solving becomes so much more prevalent, available, impactful. I think my perception is when we're all there in our own lanes, we don't see each other as competitors, whether you're a contract manufacturer and another contract manufacturer is there, equipment versus equipment. I think it is very well and properly received as a place to unite under the same ambition of growing this industry. We're better in this industry together. We can be bigger, more relevant, more impactful when we're together and building our community of users. The more people raising their hands in the audience of being a user of additive manufacturing, the more that spurs on innovation for the materials, the equipment, the software. So AMUG creates that unity where we can really work with one another and for one another, ultimately, to make each other better. So I don't think there's a place, I know for me, out of every show that I've gone to since my additive career started, there's never been a place where I've learned more and where I have developed more legs to my knowledge. And by legs, I mean other people. When I was talking earlier about having a Rolodex of people who may know things, build that Rolodex there. They understand the additive, and maybe they're pushing beyond things that you yet have had an opportunity to push on. We really focus a lot on education and networking. We do have the expo. This year, actually, we have an extra evening of the expo to allow for more conversations with the folks that are expoing, not so much for a sales focus, but just because everybody's in the same place. And I think, I know for me, I'm traveling less than I used to because people are happy with online uniting. And that makes me sad. I said when this started, I miss seeing your faces. I think coming to AMUG, you can have a lot of really qualified, quality conversations that can really build your career. Maybe not immediately, but certainly those contributions will feed you later, whether it's somebody making you smarter down the road, perhaps you're looking for a job, perhaps you're looking to learn about a new technology. So I love it. I love that we're all together. There's never, if you're outside of your room, there is always an opportunity for additive engagement. Elevator, line at the coffee shop, in a session, in the hallway. It's just it's a wonderful gift if you really want to vest in growing your additive sphere.
All right. Shannon, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about what you've done so far and about AMUG and why we should all go and visit. And yeah, thank you for being on the show today.
Well, it was very much my pleasure. I always love conversation. Thank you for volleying that with me.
Thank you, Max, for being there as well with us today.
Always a great time, Joris. Thanks for hosting.
And thank you for listening to another episode of the 3D Pod. Have a great day.
You've been listening to the 3D Pod. For more information on what you just heard or to subscribe, visit www.3dprint.com or follow us at 3dprint_com.